Hello and welcome to the Hopkins Green Tea. My name is Amethyst Devlin, and today I'm joined as always by my co-hosts,
Abigail Hunter,
Shaga Hushmandi,
Leonie Hikita.
Today's episode is a very special episode for us because it is the first time that we've welcomed one of our professors from the School of Advanced International Studies to join us in a conversation and dive a little bit deeper into some of the topics that we discuss in classroom. And I will say this professor that we're bringing on is one of the first times that as a grad student, I really felt like my perspective was heard inside of a classroom. And it was
so tough for other professors early on.
No. I mean, it's true. I felt like I bonded really early on with Professor Nam, and this is a professor that when we were all in a different class when the Inflation Reduction Act passed, and we all kind of grouped together and said, like, can we get an emergency session in with Professor Nam? It would be really, really great. But just a great professor, and I'm going to go ahead and kick it over to Leonie to introduce him further.
Yeah. Our professor, Jonas Nam, is Assistant Professor of Energy Resources and Environment at the Johns Hopkins SAIS. He studies the role of the states in the processes of industrial restructuring that accompany policy responses to climate change and the clean energy transition more broadly. His book, Collaborative Advantage, Forging Green Industries in the New Global Economy, uses the development of renewable energy sectors to investigate the policies, economy of innovations, and industrial development in highly globalized industries. In addition, he has some research projects on the policies of greening the global auto sectors, the determinants of national climate policies, and the political economy of green industrial policies. He holds a PhD in political science from MIT, and he speaks German and Mandarin Chinese. Ni hao.
I actually taught all of our classes in that way.
Well, I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, we're really grateful to have you. And the one thing we didn't mention at the top too is that you were in a large way an inspiration for us to do this podcast, because we had a podcast assignment in your class. And I think we very quickly said, oh, this is so much easier than we thought. Everyone should hear us talk all the time.
And love the sound of our voices.
I, for one, didn't do the editing for that project. And so I didn't necessarily have the full scope of how hard this would be. But, you know, it was a good team effort then, and it's a good team effort now. So thank you for that. What we want to talk about today with you is, you know, getting your perspective, stealing ideas from your book around what parts of these clean energy supply chains different countries should be doing. There's a lot of protectionist waves in different countries right now following the pandemic, where we saw a lot of exposure points where we were getting a lot of one thing from one country and then urgently needed a lot of that thing and then weren't able to access it. And now that we're really revolutionizing our grid and our automotive industries, we're seeing some similar vulnerabilities in where we get solar PV, where we get our batteries, and maybe less so the wind turbines, but certainly component parts of maybe wind turbines in terms of the minerals that go into them. And so, you know, we don't want to get too technical for our listeners, but ultimately trying to understand the nuances that exist in the policy development, where these trade-offs exist. Is it a race to the top in terms of building all these things together? Is it a race to the finish line in terms of meeting our emissions reductions goals, and it doesn't matter where we get them? Or is it probably somewhere in between those two things? And personally, I think I have a little bit of a different perspective. I've changed jobs and now work for a think tank that focuses on the national security and economic security implications of battery supply chains in particular, and so come from a very, very strong focused perspective there, not necessarily as motivated by the climate goals in our organization. I myself am, but I do find there's pragmatism in trying to elevate these conversations through those different lenses. And then I'll maybe turn it to you to kind of hear what your perspective is in this. And if you do disagree with me, as we were joking about before, if maybe it's just in my head in terms of what I'm reading and hearing.
Well, I'm excited to join you guys and see you again after just a few weeks ago. Graduation just happened. This is a regular occurrence at this point.
We were just talking about that. We haven't quite adjusted to not having homework anymore.
So I think it's a really interesting moment, right? And I think you bring up this national security dimension, which I think we probably approach from slightly different angles, but it is sort of more broadly a moment where we used to have this world where all the kinds of technologies we need to combat climate change were made in this international division of labor. And I think we're in a moment where, for political reasons, a lot of countries have decided that that division of labor is no longer sustainable. I don't think that the sort of impetus for the current kind of change in approach is really coming from a security perspective. It's primarily coming from a political perspective, where a lot of governments have decided if we have to invest $4 trillion collectively to meet 2030 climate targets by buying batteries for electric vehicles, by investing in solar panels, building wind turbines, changing the grid, getting inverters, all this sort of stuff. That's not politically feasible if most of those things are imported from abroad. And it doesn't help that the US-China relationship is sort of deteriorating at a rapid pace, and that China so happens to make a lot of those technologies. And so I think that is sort of the political backstory to this current moment where the US last summer decided to intervene quite heavily in these supply chains with the Inflation Reduction Act in order to try to bring this manufacturing home, but not just for the manufacturing, but also to create a political coalition behind climate policy that might eventually support a carbon tax in this country and sort of carry climate policy forward. And in response to the US and China's dominance in these industries, other countries around the world are sort of, you know, toying with similar policy ideas. I think the European Union is kind of thinking about what to do and trying to mount a response both now to the US subsidies, but also to concerns about being overly dependent on China. And I think in the wake of the Ukraine war, those concerns have certainly become more severe. Canada is, you know, developing an industrial strategy for these sectors. I think other countries around the world are doing the same thing. Korea is thinking about it, Japan. So this is kind of a global phenomenon of moving away from relatively free trade in these sectors and sort of an assumption that, you know, the cheapest product is the best product and whichever way it comes together is fine, to a world in which there's a lot more attention being paid to where these different parts come from, where they create jobs and what the sort of broader political benefits of these jobs are for the climate mission. And I think you can frame that in a national security perspective by saying, if we don't solve the climate problem because we can't do it politically, because we have no manufacturing sector jobs in these industries domestically, we have a national security problem at our hands. Or you can think about it more literally by thinking, if the US-China relationship gets worse, where are we at if we don't know how to make any of these things domestically, right? So I think that's sort of the situation that we're in currently, and it's a new world in a way, and we're at the very beginning of it, so we don't quite know how it's going to play out.
I was just going to pull on the one thread that you said about trade and the shift away from free trade, you know, this post-World War II where we thought that countries that traded together wouldn't go to war together, so we're going to get to peace and prosperity one trade agreement at a time. And now that we have a lot more of a managed trade system and even using climate goals, embedding those into managed trade, like giving market access, for example, for steel and aluminum, for the EU and the United States, based around it being clean, TBD on what that means. But is that going to create winners and losers? Like, are we just kind of coalescing these groups for the developed world that have the ability to kind of build those marketplaces and decarbonize, which is in some cases for heavy duty industry a luxury? Are we going to be able to incorporate meaningfully countries that are lower income that need as much help, if not more help, to meet climate goals because they're going to be going through their economic development journeys? And theoretically, we did that on the backs of coal and other fossil fuels, and we don't want them to do the same, but we want to help them leapfrog. Could you just speak to kind of how the changing trade order might impact all of that?
I mean, in many ways, it's a very nationally focused system now, and I think it's a nationally focused system primarily in rich economies, and how this is going to play out for the global south is a little unclear. This week, there was Global Finance Summit in Paris that was supposed to be thinking about how to rewire the global financial system and create debt relief for the Global South and sort of think about climate as part of that. And so there were all sorts of negotiations around, you know, debt pauses to account for climate disasters and that sort of stuff, and also financing for deployment of clean energy in the Global South. But what wasn't on the agenda really was the fact that we primarily rely on developing economies right now to be the sources of raw materials for these industries that we're trying to build in rich economies. And when developing economies outside of China are currently trying to break into some of these markets, we react, you know, not positively. So the European Union in 2019 filed a trade case at the WTO against Indonesia because Indonesia had banned exports of raw nickel in the hopes that that would bring a nickel refining and processing industry to the country, and they would be able to use their natural resources to move into higher value added activities. And last fall, the WTO decided with the European Union on this measure and basically sort of banned Indonesia from doing that. In the meantime, they were exactly successful at what they had tried to do. Chinese companies were coming to Indonesia to set up refining and processing plants. And I think Indonesia is appealing the decision and doubling down and actually expanding these export bans to other minerals and raw materials as well, right? And so in this conversation that we have currently about how to implement the Inflation Reduction Act, how to implement the Net Zero Industry Act in Europe, how the two can be combined, what the relationship between Japan, Korea, Europe, and the US should be in these industries, there isn't really a conversation about, you know, how do we get the DRC from becoming, you know, from being the world's largest cobalt supplier to also having a manufacturing industry for some of these technologies. And we know that developing countries are going to be where most of these technologies are going to have to be deployed in the future, because that's where energy demand is increasing, where the populations are increasing. And so the political argument that we're making at home, that we can't politically push an energy transition if we don't create good middle-class jobs in these industries, is an argument that we haven't really extended to developing economies that we're now pushing to increase their national commitments under the Paris Agreement without sort of giving them a ladder to be participating, I guess, in the sort of higher value added steps. And I don't think that that's necessarily, I mean, there's probably a cynical response to this. I don't think that this is necessarily by design. I think everyone is so busy reorienting in this current moment and figuring out where to secure raw materials and how to meet all these local content requirements that are coming on online, that that part of the conversation has gotten lost a little bit. But there certainly isn't a very constructive sort of system out there right now to make sure that, you know, Indonesia could eventually make its own batteries and export them to other countries.
Right. And just for awareness for our listeners, nickel, which Jonas just mentioned, is used in EV batteries. And then it's also enables stainless steel to be used in a multitude of applications, not specific to the clean energy transition, but nickel itself is used in geothermal, in hydrogen, high amounts, in medium amounts, in solar panel, concentrating solar panel, nuclear, wind, bioenergy, hydroelectric, and solar PV, the last three of which are a little bit lower, but you just kind of see the breadth of which we need that. And Indonesia produces 50% of the world's nickel right now. And then other countries that have the other reserves, Australia only produces 6%, and that's because of the high labor costs affiliated with getting it from Australia, and then the competitiveness of Indonesia's nickel because they don't have as much high standards in extraction, which is another kind of layer to this too, because a lot of these lower income countries don't have the same standards that the United States and other allied countries tout in terms of what they bring to the table from an ESG perspective.
I want to go back to that comment you made, actually, Abigail, about the protectionism. And usually, like, policies with an element of protectionism, like what Europeans say about the IRA, they basically, the policies that in other countries become protectionist as well. So there is a reaction, like if the US is acting like China is restricting the export of technologies to the US, they're not going to just sit down and suffer. So what we're seeing is that US is actually working against all the values of free trade that basically the whole economy of the US was based on. And I'd like to know what you think about that, especially in the energy sector, and also about rising of technological nationalism. If we are all like working towards combating climate change, then why does it matter that one technology is made and exported from one country? Why can't we all work together on that?
I mean, we got to this world of interdependence, I think, in some ways, sort of by accident, right? Different countries were good at doing different things. They had different kinds of training institutions, different kinds of domestic financial markets. And it so happened that the US is really good at research and development. We have a lot of legal institutions that help universities spin off startups. The Europeans are very good at vocational training. And so they have, you know, a lot of small and medium-sized manufacturers that are quite labor intensive and sort of very custom in what they do. So they make a lot of manufacturing equipment. And China just built an incredible manufacturing machine over the last 40 years and has a lot of institutions to support it. And so we ended up with this world in which a lot of the final product manufacturing was done in China. It didn't only benefit China. Germany got rich over the last 20 years by selling manufacturing equipment to Chinese plants. But if you end up in a world where 97% of the world's solar wafers are made in China, and China also makes large chunks of other, we can go through the list of clean tech. In every industry, there's one part of the supply chain where China is incredibly dominant. I think you don't have to be a protectionist to be a little bit concerned, right? Like, you want, as a company, not just have all of your products come from one supplier in case that supplier fails. And so there is sort of a natural inclination to say, can we diversify a little bit? And so in addition to this argument I laid out earlier that there are political motivations to bring this back, I think there's some good economic reasons to think about, you know, diversifying the supply chain. But I think a lot of the problems then come with how do you implement that, and how quickly do you implement that? And one thing in the climate space is that we're pushing up against time. We have to get a lot of new technology into the ground. And so reinventing the system is going to take some time. It's also going to make it more expensive at a time when we already are battling inflation. And it also, and I think you pointed that out in your question, sort of runs the risk that everyone's doing this, and so we're just all fighting with each other. And I don't think that's really going to happen. I think we're probably going to see sort of a fragmentation of the world into two economic blocks. There'll probably be sort of a China side and like a US side, and the supply chains will have to be organized slightly differently according to those sort of different political clusters. But there's also risk in that, right? And so China has started making a little bit of noise about the chokeholds that they have control over in these different supply chains. They haven't actually acted on it at this time, but they have said that they're reviewing export controls, for instance, on wafer manufacturing equipment, where they have a global lead. If you're looking at these announcements in the US of all sorts of battery plants that are being announced by US auto manufacturers for their EV strategy, Chinese firms also play a role there because they have a lot of the technology. So for LFP, this is getting very technical, but LFP batteries use a different set of raw materials, and so they're not so dependent on some of these mineral supply chains that standard lithium ion batteries use. Chinese firms are very good at making those, and so Ford, for instance, is in a collaboration with CATL, a Chinese battery manufacturer, and building a plant in Michigan. And so now China is saying, well, actually, let's take a closer look at this collaboration because we want to make sure that Ford doesn't end up with this technology. And so from the US perspective, we've always worried about intellectual property violations in China, but China is now worried about maintaining its sort of economic lead in areas where it's built a technological advantage. And so how this is all going to play out, I think, you know, I think determines essentially the answer to your question. It doesn't have to be this complete anarchy where everyone's pushing technological nationalism, but it is an adjustment from the current system, and it's going to have some hiccups along the way.
But I want to just to follow up, correct me if I'm mistaken, I believe that US has more business in China than China has more business in the US, So what if China retaliates and then somehow US actually economically suffer that way?
It's a big question.
I mean, I don't think that's going to happen sort of across the spectrum, but it is, of course, a much more tense kind of economic relationship at the moment. The US, you know, government, the Biden administration, is trying to, I think, lay out a framework at the moment. There have been a number of big speeches by Yellen and Jake Sullivan sort of trying to define the rules of the US-China economic relationship. And I think one thing that China is very concerned about is that these US policies, like the export controls for semiconductors, for instance, are sort of trying to contain China and prevent it from becoming as rich as the United States. And I think the Biden administration is trying to make the point that there are some technologies that have national security applications where the US just has to sort of maintain its technological lead. But that doesn't mean that the US government wants Walmart to diversify its supply chains from China, right? And so they're trying to sort of thread the needle and lay out which technologies are kind of security sensitive and which ones aren't. But that's a difficult thing to do in practice. And there's lots of gray areas where that's not so easily done. So there is, of course, always the potential that this could escalate. But it seems that I think on both sides, like, people are trying to be careful.
Yeah, I think every single auto manufacturer, and for the most part, a lot of the, I would say most of the downstream, they appreciate that this is the number one market for them to sell to. There's more EVs on the roads in China than anywhere else right now. And so they can't kind of lose that market. What were you going to ask?
I was just going to try to see if we could maybe dip our toes into some of the implications socially in the United States. Should we pressure the manufacturing system to be relocated here, especially when it comes to like mining? And specifically the implications that means for like indigenous land, and that I know that this may be not your specialty, but I think that me as an energy student, I've always focused my mind on those implications, and we've learned from things like hydro that we took away a lot of land from indigenous peoples, and that has also shown up in this space. There's also that domestic like side that bringing it here doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to happen, right? Like, there are so many roadblocks. We're against time. Like, is that necessarily the best stake to be taking?
I mean, you've seen since the passing of the IRA, a lot of Treasury guidances on different elements of the bill. And so the Inflation Reduction Act had very clear local content requirements for different technologies and or bonus tax credits for things that were made here. But it didn't fully define what local content means. There were sort of technical details that were left to Treasury to define. And I think what we've seen over the last year is that most Treasury guidance has been sort of leaning towards a little more flexibility in how to interpret these things, so that what means, you know, what a free trade agreement means is a little bit looser now as a definition than what, you know, we've applied in other cases. And so countries that qualify for these tax credits, or material that come from countries that qualify for these tax credits, is a little bit more flexible than it initially appeared when the bill was passed. So not everything has to come from here, right? Like, that's sort of one thing. But I think you raise a good point about the sort of sustainability of these supply chains, right? And these, the mineral needs for this transition, and where all of this is coming from. I think we have a lot more control over these kinds of standards if we're doing it at home, and we can actually structure the conversations around land use and who's part of the conversation and who gets to speak at the table and how they're being compensated or included, and sort of what the options are there, than if we're sourcing it from Papua New Guinea and we have basically no idea what's happening. So I think that's sort of one reason to say it doesn't have to be bad. But there is a lot of, I mean, we've tried to do lithium mining in the US before and it didn't work because no one wanted it in their backyard. So that's, I think, a difficult, you know, process to run through, and definitely a difficult process to run through in very short periods of time. And so I think the sort of added flexibility that's now come through the Treasury guidances maybe buys us a little bit more time in doing this well domestically while we source from other places in the meantime. but it's a hard problem to solve. And one thing that we're not really discussing much, I mean, I think there are people like Thea Riofrancos who are discussing this, is that we're doing this transition in the automotive sector by switching from really big cars to really big cars. It's just that they now use really big batteries, right? And so if you want to minimize your environmental footprint, like buy an e-bike, like you don't have to buy a truck. And so that conversation is not really happening anymore because we're somehow absolving ourselves of our environmental responsibility in the EV transition by buying an electric car. At least that's how the kind of public conversation is structured in the US. And I think thinking a little bit about that, you know, electric cars also have an environmental impact and a social impact on the people whose land is used to mine for nickel and lithium and all these other things that we need. And so maybe buying a small electric car is better than buying a big electric car because you can just power a lot more car batteries with the same amount of raw materials. I think that's a conversation that would certainly help, you know, also address some of these issues that you've mentioned. And so we can't just suddenly stop investing in public transit because we've solved the carbon problem in the auto sector, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. I mean, I would just follow that up with even like if we looked at like the ESG rating that came out about Tesla and like the public kind of perception and uproar about like the ESG system must be broken because this company that does so much for our environment, why are they not getting a good ESG score? And it's like, it's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, but it kind of has to be like a yes and, right? Because we're never going to be able to create these vehicles and the batteries that are the most expensive parts of them without a high amount of demand. And so, you know, the market's looking to that, the investments that these companies are, you know, are making are looking to that assurance that the investments they're making are ultimately going to churn a profit because they're for-profit organizations. And so if we start to pivot to like the use less like debate, and then we don't have the ability to kind of move the market. So, you know, we're hamstrung by that aspect of the debate, I think. And then I did just want to add or clarify for listeners who maybe don't know why we're talking about free trade agreement countries. It's a component part of meeting the requirements for the 30D tax credit in the Inflation Reduction Act, which we talked about, I think, in our second or third episode that you can listen to. But essentially, the sourcing provisions of where you're going to get the minerals or, you know, the battery materials to a certain degree have to be attached to either being in a free trade country or coming from North America.
I would add to this that there is, maybe on the positive sort of side of the ledger, there is a new requirement for companies to be much more transparent about their supply chains in a way that we didn't have in the past, right? And so some of these issues that you rightly bring up, I think in the past we just didn't really get to because a lot of companies didn't even know where their stuff was coming from, right? Because it's like a supplier of a supplier of a supplier that's sourcing. And so there is this new moment now where companies are kind of investigating for themselves where all their parts are coming from. And that's partially, I think, driven by these local content requirements that just require very clear proof of the entire sort of flow of the goods through the supply chain. But it's also driven by sort of a heightened kind of geopolitical tension, worries about a China-Taiwan conflict and so on that leads countries to now investigate actually like what's in the car that I'm selling and which chips are coming from where. And so I think there's sort of a different moment now. Supply chains are incredibly fluid. I think everything is shifting. It'll settle and then it'll be settled for quite a long time. So this is sort of a moment of reorganizing the global, rewiring the global system. But it's also a moment of sort of investigating of what that system actually looks like and sort of how all these parts are connected. And so I think there's opportunity in that, in finding out where things are coming from and what the labor conditions are and the environmental conditions. And so I think we're getting a lot more information all of a sudden, because sort of corporates are, you know, digging themselves and trying to figure out where these things are, and they're being held to higher standards, you know, on some of these issues.
So you briefly mentioned the complication of energy policy. I'd like to elaborate the impact of US domestic energy policy on other countries. Some of the clean energy policies in the States are trying to adopt more renewable energies, while the US is trying to cut China, which is the biggest producer of these renewable energies and semiconductor chips. from all supply chains. Meanwhile, the US enhances business collaboration with other Asian countries that have advanced technology such as Korea, Japan, and Taiwan. And the US might encourage these countries to isolate China as well. But China's presence in Asian regions is huge. For most Asian countries, the biggest importer or exporter is China. Then for these Asian countries, the business collaboration with the US might affect the revenue as well as the diplomatic relations with China. So my point is that one clean energy policies made in the States context to decarbonize the domestic industry will have a huge global impact and affect the diplomat or security issues. This is one of the interesting points, also complicated points of energy policies.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. It would have all these ripple effects. If you listen to the current administration sort of talk about these policies, I think they've made it very clear that market access in the US is a privilege, not a right. I think that's the language they're using. And they're saying that they would like to leverage market access to achieve political goals. And climate change is one of them, right? So you can say, you can produce, you know, we will count your products as domestic if you meet certain environmental conditions, for instance, or certain kind of sustainability, social conditions. And so I think that's a big shift from basically sort of thinking about the US as an open market and anyone can come. But it has, of course, effects on countries that have somehow not had to align themselves, right? So I was just doing a lot of interviews in Germany in a couple of weeks ago on sort of the response to the IRA. And I feel like German companies and also politics had sort of thought we were in kind of a post-political world for the most part. And now all of a sudden they have to respond to China, you know, focusing more on domestic brands and domestic production, and the German auto exports to China are kind of, you know, under threat. The US putting in kind of domestic local content requirements. And so all of a sudden the economy is completely political and everything is kind of negotiated in a way that it didn't have to be in the past.
Right.
So I think that's a period of adjustment. And I don't have a good answer for where that will end. I wonder if a country like Brazil will have to, you know, go with China or go with the US or can sort of trade with both and be part of both of those sort of, you know, clusters equally. I think that's sort of a question to investigate over the next 5 or 10 years. But it's certainly a big departure from where we've been, where I think for the last 70 years, there's been sort of a progressive goal to take down tariffs, remove barriers. I mean, not always successfully, not always fairly. I think developing countries haven't always gotten, you know, a fair shake in that game either. But now I think it's turned explicitly political and it's being used very explicitly for political goals, which could go wrong, but could also be an opportunity to create climate clubs and sort of, you know, make trade with each other dependent on meeting certain sustainability goals and so on. So I see the concerns, but I also think it's an opportunity.
I want to be in a climate club.
this is kind of a climate club, no?
Yeah, we meet in an underground speakeasy in DC.
So, Professor Nam, you've got an article about why United States should actually work with China to fight the climate change. In that, you actually propose some ways to do that, like how China can use US and how US can use China to, and basically collaborate with each other. So my question is, what if we start using renewable technologies as goods for friendship and trade and work with China, like, and that way actually improve the bilateral friendship?
Yeah, I think climate policy, at least under the Obama administration, was sort of an opening to talk about more difficult issues in the bilateral relationship. In part because the US and China have sort of common interests in fixing this problem. They're jointly the biggest emitters. And so you can't really address the climate problem without having the US and China work on this together. I think the space for that has considerably narrowed in the current moment, but it doesn't mean that we can completely ignore each other. And you're seeing this in this example of the battery plant that we talked about earlier, where there's still some learning that has to happen from each other. And it's not just learning about technologies. There might be sort of new technologies that are best manufactured in China or in collaboration with China, but there's also learning in terms of how do you build up a national kind of manufacturing infrastructure in the United States that we've neglected for so long. And you're seeing that we're actually copying some of China's approaches. So Ford last week got a huge loan from the Department of Energy to build 3 battery plants in Tennessee and Kentucky. The Kentucky plants will employ more people than the Kentucky coal industry, but using sort of government loans at favorable rates in order to achieve manufacturing outcomes that are politically desired is what China has done for a long time through its state development banks, right? Unfortunately, we don't really have a state development bank in that way, but we've used the Department of Energy sort of as a, you know, makeshift development bank for manufacturing at the moment. But that's something that we've learned from China. And in the same announcement, Ford announced that it is working with the state governments in Tennessee and Kentucky to establish training institutions for manufacturing workers, because we don't actually have a workforce yet that can work in these plants. And they resemble in some ways what the Germans have done for a long time, right? So just because we're also in a more competitive global economic environment doesn't mean we can't borrow ideas from one another. And in some ways we should. And I think a lot of folks in the US were a little bit surprised when it turned out that for some of these battery technologies, we need to rely on Chinese partners because domestic auto firms don't have, you know, the expertise. I think for the longest time, we always thought technology flows from here to there, and it hadn't entered anyone's mind that for some things, it flows the other way too. And so, you know, I think that realization might actually open up some pathways to be more constructive in the relationship, because it doesn't seem so one-sided anymore. And we also realize that we're dependent on, you know, Chinese know-how in some of these areas.
But to your point earlier about assuring the, you know, an amethyst question about making sure that we're doing this in a high standard way with regards to community engagement and, you know, other environmental considerations that go into building these supply chains, we can't be running into the arms of China either, because there's forced labor being used in solar supply chains.
I mean, historically, you know, our China relationship was sort of driven by the assumption that economic engagement will lead to political change. And I think you've seen that kind of fall apart and then really come to a head during the Obama administration, where it became clear that China wasn't somehow democratizing as a result of WTO membership and sort of economic engagement with the US, right? And so what we're seeing now is kind of the emergence of a new paradigm for how to handle this. And so I don't think we're running into the arms of China in any kind of way, but I think we also have to be aware, especially in the climate space where there are kind of interdependencies and, you know, how quickly we can resolve them and where we might need to collaborate. And on the global kind of carbon discussion, we need to work together for sure, because we can't do it.
Right.
And so, you know, you can't just sort of like, you know, kill the relationship because your previous paradigm was kind of misguided and it didn't yield what you wanted. But I also think that, you know, competition is good for business. And for the longest time, the Belt and Road Initiative, for instance, that China has sort of used to export and invest and finance energy projects and all sorts of projects, infrastructure in the developing world, didn't really have a Western counterpart. And it also didn't have any kind of environmental standards, but there wasn't, you know, a US-European alliance that would go to African countries and offer similar projects, but under better conditions with more environmental conditions attached, right? And so I think there is also opportunity in the current moment to come up with new kinds of initiatives that have better environmental outcomes or, you know, care more about, you know, social sustainability and so on. And sort of some competition with China might actually motivate us to do more, when in the past we've basically just relied on China to do it, or we've neglected to respond to it. I don't know really what the kind of reasoning was, but there certainly weren't sort of alternative options available to Vietnam trying to build energy facilities. And so China was the only game in town, and they got coal plants as a result. And so I think we can do both. We can both sort of hold each other accountable and be careful about how to manage the relationship while also competing on some things where competition is good. And you've also seen sort of China as the motivation for some of these bills that have passed in the US that very clearly were sort of framed as a response to China's dominance in these industries. And I think they've been politically more successful as a result. So, you know, I think we've moved from a world where we're very optimistic about engagement to one where we have to manage it a lot more carefully. And so it's becoming more complicated, but I don't think it means that there's no collaboration, that all collaboration is bad, or that competition is bad, and we can't sort of benefit from competition politically by getting things through.
It feels like a very optimistic dynamic to end on.
Do I get a closing statement?
Sure, yeah, please. We yield
one more thing. I have one more thing to say. No, I mean, I think just sort of following on from the last point, what we're also seeing is that as countries are trying to respond to the IRA, for instance, in this new world of industrial policy, of government intervention, there's a lot of structural constraints in different places. And so this industrial policy will not look the same, and not everyone will be equally equipped to do all of these things, right? The IRA itself is basically a budget measure, and that's because we have this reconciliation loophole where you can get things through the without having the filibuster. And so it's very limited in what it touches, and it has very distinct tools that it employs. That may not be the best way to organize things, but that was the best thing we could do in the US. The Europeans cannot do that because the European Union doesn't tax anyone. Taxes are happening at the national level. And so the European industrial policy will look very different from the IRA. And it might be good for different kinds of technologies or different segments of the supply chain. So, you know, we've talked a lot about sort of what this world looks like and how much nationalism there will be. But I think these sort of domestic constraints on how policies are made, what's possible politically, what you know how to do, what you can learn from others, will also create a world that is somewhat fragmented in how governments are intervening in these different supply chains in different ways with different tools. And so I don't think we're completely moving away from a world where there's interdependence and we have to exchange things. But we are moving towards a world where the economy is political and where governments are intervening. And let's hope they're doing this for good reasons and with good goals. And it seems to be the case right now that climate is at the forefront of all of this, which I think is a good
thing. Awesome.
Wow, that was a great closing statement. Thank you. Thanks, Dr. Jonas Nam, for sharing your expertise and providing us with valuable insights. And a special thank you goes out to all our listeners who tuned in to this episode of Hopkins Green Tea. We hope you enjoyed listening to our conversation as much as we did and gained some valuable knowledge from it. For more information on the podcast, visit SAIS Perspectives website or follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter using @HopkinsGreenTea handle. If you could spare a moment to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, it would mean the world to us. Your feedback and support are incredibly valuable in helping us expand our reach and engage with a wider audience. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye. Bye. Cheers. Thank you.